thought they disappeared. You thought 2019 was going to be the most 2019 of all, with the permanent absence of your favorite podcast about two people who judge movies on trailers alone. Well, you thought wrong, because I'm Lisa Schmeiser, this is Philip Michaels, and we are Phil and Lisa Ruin the Movies.
I feel like I'm just witnessing this. Yes, clearly not hearing our podcast is absolutely the worst thing that has happened in 2019.
I didn't say it was the worst thing. Yeah. I just said 2019 was going to 2019.
Okay.
All right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here we are.
Here we are.
We're
so
back.
So it's a good thing in 2019.
Yeah.
But a terrible thing brought us out of
our
quasi.
A terrible occurrence.
And we're not talking about the health scares we've had this year.
No.
We're not talking about the overwork we've had at the day job.
No.
We're not talking about when we fled the country under cover of darkness with our child.
Mm-hmm.
Force return.
Yeah.
We're talking about something so terrible, so stunningly horrible. We were forced to come back and begin podcasting.
You know, occasionally something happens that is so mind-blowingly awful that I think it unites people.
Yeah.
It gives them a common purpose.
30 to 50 feral hogs.
Yes. It makes them see that... you know, despite our differences, we really have to band together to fight against the Cats trailer.
Because it's an abomination. Holy, oh my God.
Holy cow, that is.
Or Holy Cats is the
case. Yeah, Holy Cats. Well, you know, I don't claim to necessarily be the world's most religious man, but and I don't throw around the words affront to God lightly, but when you have cat people with that make the human animal hybrids in the island of Dr. Moreau seem tasteful and understated. When there is CGI fur and the cats are walking around, and the first thing you think are, what happened to the cat's genitals? And there's tails coming out of people's butts.
I think what's remarkable is that I have actually seen news stories where the headlines have read furries. We're not happy about this either.
No, when even the furries are turning their nose up at your project.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Hopper?
Yeah.
I don't care enough about who's it to get his name right.
No.
He gave us
this abomination.
You brought cats into our life, Tom Hooper.
So I think we could probably do an itemized list. Let's stick to the top 10 items that we hated the most about this trailer and why.
Okay. But by way of that, I want to talk a little bit of background. I saw Cats.
I did too. I saw it when I was a teenager.
Yeah, I saw it in 1984, I want to say, in San Francisco.
Touring
company.
1986, touring company in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
I was a teenager.
And so you see it, and they've got the set, and there's a little garbage, and it's cat-sized.
And you're like watching people dance, and when you're watching the live performance, what you're kind of brought into... Like, okay, when you start a live performance, there's always a contract between the audience and the performer. Mm-hmm. The contract is, I will do my best to suspend disbelief. You will do your best to express something to me. Mm-hmm. And together, we'll have this experience. We each play a part. Like, you can't have a live performance without an audience. You cannot have a live performance without performers, right?
Right.
And the great thing about seeing Cats as a teenager was watching these people, like, run around on stage like they thought they were cats.
Yeah.
I can remember watching this as a teenager going, the human body does amazing things, and these people have, like, they're paid to go pretend to be cats. It was wild.
So two things about the Cats the Stage Show. Not my favorite musical.
No.
Not my least favorite musical. Kind of a solid B-. A gentleman's C, maybe, if you're
the
being...
one thing I can be grateful for is that introduced me to T.S. Eliot. And
yeah.
I jumped from the old Possum's Book of Practical Cats into his other poems. And it's been...
That's a hell of a jump.
But, you know, I was 14. I didn't know any better. I made it, and I'm grateful I did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's there's no story to the musical. It's basically just a bunch of randos dancing around.
The best thing about Cats is the dancing and a little bit of the singing. And no one goes into Cats saying... Man, that story in Cats, that was something. That plot line in Cats. And apparently...
There is no plot line
And apparently
Cats,
the people making Cats, Tom Hooha,
have
decided, you know, what we really need, what this Cats needs...
Is a plot.
Is a story. What we want is the cats having adventures and talking. Talking, not singing and dancing.
Yeah.
talking and saying, hey,
so,
wouldn't it be great if we
can... the trailer, would you consider talking to be one of the top 10 bad things?
Yes.
Okay. So number 10, we have talking in the trailer.
And I would also say number 9, apparently they've decided, let's give it a plot. Let's plot up that Cats. Okay. Rather than it just being a showcase for singing and dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would also throw in, from the live show, mm-hmm. when you've got people who have to be on stage, like 10, 15, 20 feet away from other human beings, who know, those are not cats up there.
Yeah.
The costumes have a bit of a fantastic quality to them in the live stage show, where you look at them and go, yeah, okay, I'll buy in. I paid my, whatever it was in 1984 dollars. I paid my $40 to get in.
Yeah.
I
think what I loved about the costumes is they were so specifically of a time and a place. Mm-hmm. And so my number 8 on this list, because mm-hmm. I haven't had one yet, my number 8 is I hate the aesthetic. I really hate the weird, sleek CGI aesthetic because it doesn't lean into the glorious and nonsensical excesses of the musical. Mm-hmm. And, like, again, in the live stage musical, you have the contract between audience and performer. The performers are bringing it. It's all excess. Like, that's the whole musical might as well just be called No Taste, We Overdid It.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine.
You're the Rum-Tum-Tugger has shoulder pads.
Yeah.
And a diving neckline.
Yeah.
And this Rum-Tum-Tugger
mm-hmm.
Does not. He has nothing, not even cat genitals.
Well, I don't want to see cat junk.
Well, if you're gonna do photorealistic cats.
Well, if you're gonna do photorealistic cats, Jennifer Hudson has 6 nipples.
Exactly.
Oh.
Now you're getting it. So that's number 6. No 6 nipples.
Oh my God. We've gone off the rails.
You made the top 10, so we have to fill somehow.
No, I was gonna say number 5. My complaint is casting.
Yeah. Okay.
Because here's, you want to know how I can tell a movie is just gonna be a disaster?
Uh-huh.
When it is marquee star after marquee star after marquee star after marquee star, because what that tells me is that they didn't cast for the best person for the part. They cast for focus grouping and box office opening, which means they're not concerned about the art so much as they're about the commerce. And I get that movie making is a business and not a hobby, but at the same time, why would I bother giving you my money if what you've done is focus group the hell out of everyone you've put in this movie and decided which actor is there to extract money from my pocket?
Well, to that I would add, and I don't know if this is 4, I don't know if this is 5A, you'll be the judge.
I will.
James Corden.
Ugh.
Well, who in America is saying, put James Corden in everything?
I think he's number 4, frankly. He's just that much.
Who? Because I would like to meet these people in, like, one of those rooms that are similar to those Chevrolet commercials where the focus group guy comes out and says, oh, I see you are looking at a truck. Have you considered a Chevy? I want to be that guy because I also have a stupid beard.
Uh-huh.
And I can come out and say, oh, so I see you like James Corden. What the hell is wrong with you? And then... Because I don't know.
That kind of open-ended question gets a lot of answers.
It does. Well, my dad never liked me, and I always felt I didn't have a place in the world, and neither does James Corden, so I feel a symbiotic relationship.
Oh,
am I using the word symbiotic correctly? I don't care.
No, you're not.
Because,
this is why your father never liked
because
you.
My father was a vocabularian. Is that a word? No. Okay, well, now you see the depth of his hatred of me. And that's why, you know, James Corden makes me feel better, because it's someone people hate more. So
I think the best part about...
Yes, go on. Let me jump in. So the other day we were going to watch Ocean's 8.
We were, yes.
And you wanted to see the trailer first.
Yeah.
And
oh my God, the full
The body. First thing they show in the trailer is James Corden, and you actually do it. You did the
I recoiled like a vampire confronted with a rosary.
And let me tell you, I've seen Ocean's 8, and it's a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
You know.
Can you digitally remove James Corden like all those angry men children removed Rey from the latest Star Wars movie?
He actually does not show up until very late in the movie. Spoiler alert for those of you who don't want to, like, go into a movie thinking, at what point does James Corden show up and ruin everything? Anyhow, he shows up in Ocean's 8. And even though I was watching this on a plane, it was like all the air got sucked out of the plane.
Oh,
I was waiting for the mask to drop down, and the pilot to come on. Yeah, we're You know, we've had a loss in pressure cabin. One of you is watching Ocean's 8, and James Corden has just appeared on screen and sucked all the air out of our plane. And, I'm going to ditch the plane in the ocean now. And that is how I feel about James Corden.
So what was amazing was when you and I were at a barbecue last month, populated by lots of native British and Scottish people. Actual British people. And all of them to a person said, can you explain why America loves James Corden? Because we didn't like him on our island.
They kicked him out.
And I said feebly, well, he wasn't bad in Gavin and Stacey, but if I had to rank the cast members, he's certainly not in the top.
No.
And then we all agreed it was an unjust world.
Yes.
No, I don't get James Corden. I don't. To get back to the casting thing, there was this marquee list of, you like this famous person, these two English people look flaccid up, look, here's some teen idols. Oh, Rebel Wilson as the fat, funny girl.
Mm-hmm.
And also some ballerina who is going to try and carry the choreography, and I don't care.
And is apparently now the emotional center of the musical.
Also, what they did to Idris Elba in that trailer makes no sense whatsoever. Well, I felt the same way, because I quasi-watched X-Men Age of Apocalypse, and by quasi-watched, I mean I used a heavy hand on the fast-forward button.
Sure.
But what I don't understand about X-Men Age of Apocalypse is you take Oscar Isaac, who is a marvelously nuanced and subtle and intensely charismatic actor. Like, so charismatic that his character is still alive in the Star Wars universe, despite supposedly being written off.
Mm-hmm.
They were like, oh my God, we can't kill Oscar Isaac. He's so charismatic. They brought him back, right?
Right.
That's the power of Oscar Isaac. So some genius associated with the X-Men movies says, let's take that and bury that under 50 pounds of blue latex and then stick Olivia Munn in front of him.
Yes, and not...
And so that was the big error there.
Mm-hmm.
They did that same thing to Idris Elba, where you take Idris Elba, who is a man who's got a command and a screen presence.
Sure he does.
And they're like, why don't we stick weird CGI cat stripes and a fedora on him?
And give him whiskers.
Yeah, because, you know, that's why women go to see Idris Elba. They want to see him when he's completely unrecognizable.
I have this terrible feeling that the people behind the Bond movies, where you go, oh, well, the people have spoken. We must make Idris Elba the new James Bond. Oh, let me bring up the YouTube and watch this new Cats trailer. Oh, my God, he can never be Bond now. He's a kitty cat.
He's a little too old to be Bond.
He's a little, yeah.
That should have happened 10 years ago.
It should have, but it didn't. So.
Now you can make John Boyega James Bond.
Yeah.
Boyega's charismatic, too. They did some great casting on those Star Wars movies.
Yeah, they really did.
Like, and I saw his earlier one, I wouldn't call it Stomp the Block.
Something
the Block.
Something the Block.
I can't remember. I'm an old woman.
Surrender the Block. No, Seize the Block. Yeah.
But it's one of his first movies. It's him and a bunch of no-names, and I'm sure their mothers all love them. I did fine. But it's him and a bunch of working actors, and he leaps off the screen with charisma.
He's quite good in another movie whose name I'm forgetting. It's set in Detroit in 1967.
Yeah.
I think it might actually be named Detroit 1967, but he's quite good in that.
Yeah, anyway, point is John Boyega should be our new James Bond.
Well, there you go. It's
we
settled.
We have three
And no one made him be a cat.
No, and we have three things left about the Cats trailer that we hated.
Uh-huh.
What I hated about it was I hate the proportions, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because here's the thing. They're not cat-sized. I've had cats. They're rat size. And so now every time I look at that screen, all I see is a flood of stupid anthropomorphic rats.
It is like we are back in the 1980s and Roger Corman is at American Independent Pictures and says, yeah, gonna make a cats movie. Now we're gonna beat them to the punch. We'll call it Rats and it'll be about singing rats and we'll film it in 3 days.
Oh, yeah. No, it's just... And, you know, at this point, I feel... have we talked about how bad the CGI is in the trailer?
It's really bad. Is that number two?
Is that... it's my number two.
Yeah, it should be... won't you be my number two?
Oh, well, me and number one are through.
Mm-hmm.
And the CGI looks terrible. And the thing is, I don't mind CGI when it's done to visually enhance a story or when it's, like... Or when it's done to provide a really distinct visual patina, like whenever we watch Speed Racer, which is plot-wise a hot mess of a movie, but whenever we watch it, we're like, God bless America, the Wachowski siblings did an amazing job.
It is for all of Speed Racer's faults as a movie,
yeah,
and they are legion and manifold.
Starting with Emil Hirsch.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
it is a visually interesting picture. Yeah. You do not sit there and watch Speed Racer and go, boring, fake.
No, it's they do a great job of using the special effects to suck you into a world that is visually consistent and striking. And what happened in this trailer was exactly the opposite, mm-hmm. where everything sat wrong on the eye, like it was Polar Express levels of wrong.
Yeah.
So deeply disturbing and weird.
Uncanny Kitties.
Oh, yeah. No. Uncanny Kitties. There we go. That's the episode title. And so what's your number one here?
Well, we can argue about this, and, mm-hmm. and perhaps this is unfair. Mm-hmm. If as I do, you listen to Broadway soundtracks, mm-hmm. you might have your opinion on who does the best rendition of Memory. Is it Betty Buckley? Is it Ellen Page mm-hmm. or Elaine Page? Excuse me, not Ellen Page, the nice girl from Juno.
I was thinking Ellen Page from Streets of Fire in the 1980s.
Oh, excuse me, yes.
No, it's Ellen Aim.
Yeah.
Oh, we're no Michael Paré.
No, mm-hmm. no. Friend of mine. So... deep cut for those no one gets it.
Yeah.
So as I was saying, there are a lot of really good renditions of Memory, and I think the quality that persists throughout them is Grisabella is broken down and sad, and there's an aching and a longing and
postmenopausal cat. Like, that is basically her jam.
There's a vulnerability about it, and the one thing that Jennifer Hudson, a very talented singer, a very talented actress, the one thing I do not think Jennifer Hudson has an ounce of is vulnerability.
No.
And
Jennifer Hudson got her first Oscar for singing "And I Am Telling You I Am Not Going." Like,
yes.
And that whole song is basically her belting out, her giving the verbal finger to everybody in a 5-mile radius.
Yeah.
I love it. It's great. She mm-hmm. was great in Dreamgirls. Don't get me wrong. But one of the things I like about Betty Buckley's rendition is mm-hmm. Betty Buckley makes you believe, or rather encourages the leap or the inference that Grisabella lived her life. Grisabella lived fast, mm-hmm. made a lot of very bad choices when she was younger because she could not be bothered to think ahead. She is now living with the wreckage of all those choices. Oh, does she regret it all?
Mm-hmm.
And oh, does she miss when she had all those choices in front of her? And this is why she wants to go back, is because all she has left is this tiny golden window, and she wants more, and she wants to do it better. She wants a chance to redo it. You get Jennifer Hudson, and you're like, this is a woman who... Even as a cat, she's a woman who looks like she eats really well and has a great personal trainer.
Yeah.
And what does she regret?
And now Ulla Belt.
Yeah, what does she regret?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, no, I think that... And I think the casting was about 20 years too young.
Yeah, I agree with that. About the only casting decision that mm-hmm. I said, yeah, that tracks would be Judi Dench.
Yeah. Or how about Ian McKellen as the
Oh, favorite. Sure. Yes, they got the oldsters right.
What I would have preferred also is Memory is your showstopper.
Yep.
It's the reason people go, you stick it in the trailer, what incentive do I have to go?
Yeah, hold it up. Or if you're going to put it in the trailer, just put in the little teaser at the end.
What they should have done is they should have just given us Magical Mr. Mistopheles.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could have given us Rum Tum Tugger.
Yes.
Or... like basically something that shows the dynamism, but what we got instead was a bunch of disturbingly sleek looking rat cat things.
Had I been in charge of marketing the movie, I would have gone out of my way to avoid showing as much of it as possible, so that there's this hint of mystery and that people then go in and
If I had been in charge with the trailers, what I would have done is I would have dropped a different segment of song with each trailer,
right,
where you get a little hint, and then at the end Idris Elba slinks through with his little hat and then you hear dun 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 dun. That's it, but you get like little bits here and there of all the different songs, and this way, each one of the people you overpaid to be in this movie gets their showcase trailer as well.
Yeah.
And then the day before it comes out, you do one last trailer that drops. And mm-hmm. then you do have, it's so easy to leave me.
And everyone's like,
oh. Yeah. But they're committed.
She has no vulnerability.
Yeah. But they're committed to the game.
Yeah. But I've already bought the tickets on Fandango. Shit. So.
Well, but what this points to... as a whole, is that musicals are actually really hard to do now.
Yes, they are.
They're really hard to do as movies, because...
And in fact, Tom Hooha directed Les Miserables, the big screen version of that, which I did not like at all. And I am a really big Les Miserables fan.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the stage production of that, because again, that's one that makes use of its space. These actors on the stage aren't manning the barricades in 19th century Paris. They're going off to their spin cycle class.
And, yeah.
But
everybody was entirely too attractive in that.
But
except for Anne Hathaway.
But on the stage it works because it again asks you to buy into the
consensual illusion.
And
will believe it so you can believe it.
The problem with Les Miserables is they stuck it smack dab in the middle of 19th century Paris, and you see that, and then you see like people breaking out into beautiful song, and you go, my brain does not draw that connection.
Everybody was too attractive.
With the possible exception of Russell Crowe, who like sang spoke, yeah.
Oh, God. Well, it's when you and I saw Phantom of the Opera and Gerard Butler sang spoke all
yeah,
of this stuff.
That
and,
was a good one.
Oh, my Lord.
So, yeah.
The thing is musicals don't have to be hard because they didn't used to be. Singing in the Rain is a perfect example of that.
Right. I would argue that Broadway musicals have a hard time making the transition to movies.
Cabaret is an exception to that.
Cabaret. There are exceptions,
yeah,
sure.
Which is fantastic. You haven't seen Chicago. I saw it and really liked it.
I refuse to go see Chicago because I like the stage show so much that I don't want to go see the movie.
But I think...
Same thing with Sweeney Todd. Sweeney Todd is my favorite musical. I've not seen the Tim Burton movie, nor will I see the
You don't
Tim
like
Burton.
Tim Burton movies to begin
I
with.
I don't like so Tim Burton movies, and then I'm going to watch that and go, huh, this is... What I would recommend, just on the Sweeney Todd note, and then I'll shut up.
Uh-huh.
There is a semi-staged version that aired on PBS that the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra did with Patti LuPone and I think George Hearn and Doogie Howser's in it. And
Patrick Harris is very
good. It's quite good.
You and I saw the semi-staged version of West Side Story with Cheyenne Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also very good. And that, again, but you know, that actually speaks to the point I was going to make, which is that a stage musical is very different from a movie musical. Because on stage, again, part of the electricity and the magic comes from the idea that everybody is there because they want to be. And everybody wants this to work, right? Mm-hmm. But with a movie... It's almost as if the entire experience is sealed in a glass sphere, and your job as the moviegoer is to hold up the sphere and look at it and watch what goes on, and ask yourself: did it take advantage of the sphere? Did it work to the medium? Mm-hmm. And movie musicals are much different.
That's why I would argue that musicals done originally for the screen
are stronger
because they're made with that frame of reference.
Yeah.
It's you're Singing in the Rains, your Gold Diggers of 1932, things like that.
Again, I'm going to make the Cabaret exception.
And again, that's Bob Fosse doing probably a mountain of coke and saying, "This is how we'll do it."
And Gwen Verdon did a lot of the work on that too.
Yeah.
But I think, if you take a look at some of his film work, you see that he had an instinctive understanding of the differences in medium.
True.
And what I'm going to argue is that a good movie musical is one that really leans into the strengths that cinema has to offer, whether it's special effects or whether it's soundtrack or whether it's simply changing the conceit so it's slightly surrealer in someone's head.
So, since you brought up Cabaret as the exception to my rule, I'm going to bring up an exception to your rule.
Uh-huh.
The film version of Kiss Me, Kate was made, it was a 3D musical.
Oh, I remember seeing that with you.
It is a 3D, and if you watch it now without, I assume even with the 3D glasses, what is going on? But without the 3D glasses, because there are points in the musical where they're singing and they will throw things towards the camera or point at the camera or do a take to the camera. And it looks like it is directed by a crazy man.
Yeah.
It looks like we let an insane person direct this Cole Porter musical. Let's see if people like it.
That is literally the last thing you want, because Cole Porter musicals are so precise.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, everything about them is
and
so
And suddenly someone is throwing confetti at us for no purpose.
Yeah. Well, this brings up another thing, which is you and I watched Baby Driver.
Yes.
And one of the things that...
This is the Edgar Wright.
Edgar Wright.
2017 picture.
Yep, starring Ansel Elgort as the eponymous baby.
Yes.
And
no one else. Certainly no disgraced actors.
Well,
who...
let's sidestep that conversation. Yeah. Because it stars many people that you can look up on IMDb. But the thing that charmed me and sucked me into the movie was the opening credit scene where you see him walking down the street and there are lyrics in the graffiti or on street signs and he's flawlessly moving. And it's not quite a dance, but it's clearly syncopated to the soundtrack. And what I liked about it is not only did it suggest the constant musical soundtrack in Baby's head, it also showed... how magical that experience can be when it's turned out for an audience.
Mm-hmm.
And there was somebody, I think the director of photography on Baby Driver, who said, yeah, this is basically a postmodern musical because the music underscores, amplifies, and explains every emotional beat in the movie. It underscores, amplifies, and explains all of the action, and it is a vital, integral part of the movie.
I agree with all of that. I dispute it as a musical in the sense that it's not... I think it's cheating when you're using found music. Unlike, say, a Moulin Rouge, where you're using found music, but it's being sung by the people in the movie.
Yeah.
You're making a jukebox thing without the courage of your conviction to have all these people singing the song.
Huh, interesting.
It's a small little complaint.
Well,
petty one, but...
Yeah, it seems to be... I guess the question I have is, do you feel like it really compromised... do you think the lack of original music compromised the quality of the storytelling or any of the beats in the film?
It's not quite the lack of original music. It's the fact that it's all diegetic.
Yeah.
And not being sung by the characters.
So here is something I'm going to argue, is that Edgar Wright, who's our age, is... I would argue one of the first directors to really grasp, or rather one of the first directors to really internalize the MTV aesthetic and the emotional beats of MTV in the 1980s.
Or at least grasp it and do it in such a way that doesn't make you want to throw your TV screen out a window.
Yeah, because I watched Baby Driver, and a few days before that, thanks to long story we won't get into, I now have to do at least 45 minutes of cardio every day. And so I've been hitting the exercise bike and downloading things off of Netflix and getting through a lot of movies and TV that way. And so I've been watching a lot of Edgar Wright stuff. I watched Hot Fuzz, and then I watched Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And Scott Pilgrim versus the World has a lot of music in there too. And the way Edgar Wright incorporates it into that is there's both background music, but Scott Pilgrim's a musician.
Yeah.
And so he and his buddies make a lot of the music. And since the whole point of that movie is that Scott Pilgrim is trying to put himself into a heroic narrative, the music, and there's also a lot of video game convention in that movie, the music serves a really clear narrative purpose there. And the first time I watched it, I thought, oh my God, this is the first post-MTV movie. This is the first movie that really gets what it's like to grow up with a soundtrack and to internalize a soundtrack as a way to access, express, and act on your emotions in a way that I think Gen Xers and below would probably get. And I feel that we see a whole lot of that in Baby Driver too, where this is a guy who has let all of his internal soundtracks... this is how he processes everything from the death of his quarreling parents to the life he's had since to the jobs he has. And then we see him record people around him and try to remix and make his own music. And it's terrible. It's objectively terrible. But the reason he's doing that is because it's him trying to figure out how to express himself in the only mediums he's been able to internalize. So, you know, I do think there's a little bit of an argument that maybe we need to redefine musicals and make them more of pastiches. like, if you want to look at it as a pastiche musical, like, you're also not a big fan of popsicles as a thing.
No, I your Mamma Mia's and your Rock of Ages.
Yeah.
And
oh my God, I saw Rock of Ages. It was so bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Bless Tom Cruise. He tried so hard.
Yeah, it's not my favorite genre.
Yeah.
It's a source of comedy to me. You and I once we once jokingly created an Eagles popsicle called Shot of Courage.
Yes.
Yeah. Trademark, by the way. Anyone who does an Eagles popsicle now has to pay us.
Oh God, you know we're gonna get like a letter from Don Henley excoriating us.
Yeah. You mean you haven't already got a letter from Don Henley? I do not like what you do at all. Signed, Don Henley.
No, a Shot of Courage, because of course...
You've watched the Eagles documentary. Do you think Don Henley has a sense of humor about anything?
No, I don't. I feel like Joe Walsh would be cool, though.
Joe Walsh would be great. Randy Meisner, fine.
Well, except he doesn't have that alpha energy.
Timothy B. Schmidt...
Also mellow.
He would be all, whatever.
No, I'm afraid of the Dons. Glenn
Frey, not a problem anymore.
I'm afraid of the Dons, Don Felder, Don Henley.
I feel like either
one of them could be an awesome a Shot of Courage.
Yeah, I think Don.
A musical made entirely of their music. They're my obstacles.
So Shot of Courage opens.
Yeah.
A young man arrives in L.A.
Yeah.
I don't even remember. All I know is that Hotel California we decided was the showstopper at the end of Act 1.
Yeah.
And Peaceful Easy Feeling was the opener after Act 1. That's about as far as we got.
I don't remember it like that, because I remember Tequila Sunrise being where he, of course, like, betrays his friend on his way up the success. And then Hotel California is when he realizes it's all terrible.
Anyhow, you're listening to our podcast about our pitch meetings for Shot of Courage.
Pitch the Eagles. Sorry.
The Eagles popsicle that is coming soon to a theater near
you. I actually just brought up an idea that I think you and I should explore, because we have actually seen a few movies since our last podcast.
Yeah.
And I just mentioned that I think the future for movie musicals might be in a pastiche, which, as you know, is when you borrow and mix and match ideas. I wanted to get your thoughts in general about when they're like, who you think does pastiche cinema well and who you wish would stop.
Well, I mean, the Coen brothers, I don't know that you'd call it pastiche cinema, but they are clearly playing with genres and playing with the expectation of genres in various movies, whether it's the Western, which they've done.
Oh, we really love the Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Which they've done several takes on the Western.
Mm-hmm.
They've done several takes on film noir, from Blood Simple to The Man Who Wasn't There, which is a really underrated Coen brothers movie that not a lot of people have seen.
Yeah.
And of course, they've done a gangster picture. They've done all sorts of things. So
they've done several gangster pictures.
What besides Miller's Crossing?
The one with Tom Hanks, the remake of the Lavender Hill Mob.
Oh, that's not really a game. That's a kind of more of a.
It's a failure gangster.
It's a caper picture.
They're failure gangsters.
It's a caper.
They're failure gangsters.
It's a caper picture, and that is the Lady Killers for those of you.
Thank you.
Scoring
I'm just
at home.
To that.
Not the Lavender Hill Mob, but again, an Alec Guinness picture.
Okay, yeah.
Alec Guinness Ealing comedy. So
it was a long walk, but we got there.
Yeah, we got there.
There are other good caper pictures. Is Burn After Reading.
Yeah. So you like it better than I did.
I do.
So I think they generally do a good job with taking a genre and flipping your expectations of it on its head.
Mm-hmm.
The guy I wish, I don't know, stop, but the guy I think who's very overrated is Quentin Tarantino. And I guess he's been in the news lately with his...
apparently he's starting to retire
with his Manson family movie, which given my schedule of seeing Quentin Tarantino movies, I'll be seeing that about 2028, because I just got around to watching Inglourious Bastards. Which Inglourious Bastards, that came out a few years ago, didn't it? Yeah, 10 years ago it came out. And For like the first 20, 30 minutes I'm watching them, I'm all, wow, this is a really good movie. I really should have seen this sooner. This is great. And then what I call that Quentin Tarantino does his bullshit moment comes in. And you're all, I hate this movie so much. And it was
Hateful Eight.
Yeah, well, Hateful Eight, it was even quicker.
Yeah.
There's always that moment in a Quentin, outside of
Django Unchained. I saw Django Unchained without you.
Yeah.
And that was like the minute Don Johnson hit the screen, I was like, oh, really?
Yeah, there's just a certain point mm-hmm. in Quentin Tarantino movies, save for Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, where I just really tap out.
Yeah. Well, the reason you can't tap out of Pulp Fiction is you're trying to figure out how to put all the pieces of the story together.
Well, exactly.
I think what you're bringing up is an important distinction, which is that the Coen brothers always seem to push themselves a little.
Mm-hmm.
Because you watch their early stuff. For example, I don't think they'd make Fargo today.
Disagree with you, but it would be a different picture.
Yeah.
I'd put it that way.
Because what I've noticed is in a lot of their earlier films, there's a whole lot of, ha-ha, everyone's dumb and self-interested. And in later films, it's, oh, everyone's dumb and self-interested, so let's just try to be compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a little bit more gentle acceptance of the human spirit or the human condition
mm-hmm.
that you don't see in their earlier stuff.
All of their characters come to a bad end, it seems.
Well, not all of them.
Well, but for the most part.
If you look at Hail Caesar...
That's true.
The thing that one of the reasons I think Hail Caesar is one of their strongest movies is because it's one where, again, the cupidity of the human condition is fully acknowledged, and the little lies people tell themselves to go through the day are all mercilessly examined, but it points out that people don't do it to be malicious. They do it because they're self-involved and thoughtless, but not actively evil, and that's a remarkably positive thing for the Coen brothers to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you have to, that's what I find interesting about them, is you don't find people who revel in being bad guys in a Coen brothers movie. No one thinks they are.
No.
Like, they really took to mind the adage, everyone is the hero of their own movie. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they make their movies. And I think that might be disquieting, right?
Sure.
Whereas in a Quentin Tarantino movie, the bad guys all know they're bad guys.
Yes.
Like, there's no nuance. There's no...
The Christoph Waltz character in Inglourious Bastards. And a great performance by him.
That was
one thing that I really enjoyed about that picture.
Yeah.
But at no point is he approaching that that performance like, you know, he has a lot of layers. I'm going to try and bring out his more positive quality.
Yeah.
No, he's
when we watched Hateful Eight, I kept thinking it was like watching a particularly sadistic little boy mash his action figures together
mm-hmm.
and look around the corner to make sure his mom wasn't listening to the language he was using.
Yeah.
And I think this is the thing I ultimately find disappointing about Tarantino
mm-hmm.
is he has an eye. But he has an eye because, like, he has an eye the same way that a child can recite a poem. It's memorization. But it's not context. It's not understanding. And there's no deeper intellectual curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like pastiches when pastiches are people borrowing something that someone else did better, as opposed to using the pastiche as a jumping off point to play in the genre or to say something that they don't think the source material says.
Right.
So this is what bugs me about Tarantino, is I don't think he has anything to say anymore.
No, he's pretty much... it's a lot of the same movie over and over again.
It is the same movie over and over, uh-huh. which is depressing.
And as, you know, as I get older...
there are a lot of movies out there. I don't need to watch the same one 10 times.
Yeah, just... Also, mm-hmm. really uncomfortable... with the way that women are presented in these pictures. Perhaps even more so after Uma Thurman talked about how he injured her in Kill Bill, which is a movie I detest Kill Bill. That of all the Quentin Tarantino movies, and I know you kind of liked it.
I like Part 2 a whole lot. I don't...
Part 1, I tapped out within like 5 minutes of that movie. I gave up on that one.
So my big problem with Part 1 in that movie
mm-hmm.
is... You could argue that what he has other people do to the bride as a victim
uh-huh.
is meant to illustrate how strong she is because she roars back and begins taking revenge, and that sets the tone. You could argue that, right?
Sure.
What I think you can also argue is that he does that so that way you're never threatened because this is already somebody that you know can be beaten and violated. And you're watching the movie in part to see how it happened and to see if it happens again. And on some level, some viewers are probably comforted in knowing that she can be hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that makes it hostile because this is somebody who can't accept powerful or self-contained or uninjured women. He likes his women best when they're hurting.
Yeah.
and it's really awful to watch. But you know what? We've already run him down. Let's talk about some of the movies that we have liked over the past 2019 or so.
The past year?
Oh, God. Sorry, listeners. You've been so good and so patient.
You've been very patient. We apologize. We're working out some things. Yeah. But it'll, hopefully.
Well, not with each other.
No.
We're solid as a rock.
Yeah.
Look, work's been crazy. Life's been crazy. Anyhoodle, let's see. Some of the movies that I've really liked lately. Trying to think. Like I said, I went on that Edgar. I keep wanting to say Edgar Winter kick, and that
that would be a totally different movie.
No, I saw the Edgar Wright movies. Mm-hmm. The truth is, it's been hard to watch movies because it's too they're so long now, and it's a big commitment of time, so to speak.
Yeah.
And TV is easier because it's just 42 minutes of my life.
I have a couple.
Oh yeah, I did see the Last Avengers movie.
Yeah, what did you think of that?
Well, you know what? There are lots of incomparable podcasts where I'm sure they talked about it too.
No. I wasn't on any of them. I'm pretty sure that they haven't gotten around to that on the incomparable.
So if all of you completists were like, "Oh, Lisa's the one member of the incomparable we hadn't heard about with the Avengers," good news, nerds. Because these next 2 minutes are for you. I think the Russo brothers did a fantastic job sticking the landing.
Okay.
I think they had a tremendously complicated job to do in terms of narrative storytelling because they had 22 movies to wrap up ahead, you know, leading into that. And they had countless characters, and they're supposed to wrap up storylines for some characters while launching others into new franchises. And they're supposed to signal an ending of one really ambitious thing, which we'll probably never see again in terms of scope and ambition. And they're supposed to leave the door open for subsequent things that don't disappoint people. They did it. And they did it in a way where every character managed to get a moment, and they did some really great fight sequences. Mm-hmm. They've always had a great eye for choreographing fight sequences, and it really pays off here. And it was funny, and I liked it a lot, and my complaints were comparatively few. It's probably, I would argue that the Russo brothers Avengers movies are, to me, better than Joss Whedon's Avenger movies.
Well, there's a bar to clear.
So
I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Although I was on a flight last week from Dallas to San Francisco. Uh-huh. It was one of those older planes where they don't have the individual screens on the back of the chairs, mm-hmm. that where you can enjoy your own movie.
Yeah.
So instead they showed a movie on the tiny screens, and I always fall asleep on flights at the beginning out of sheer terror.
It's like you're an opossum. It's
yes, no, I pass out. And mm-hmm. and so I wake up about an hour into the flight, and the Avengers movie is on. And I don't know if you know about the length of the Dallas to San Francisco flight, but by the time we were ready to land, it was not the ending of the movie, and the screens pop up, and that's the end. So now the audiences will never see the bit where Ant-Man flies up of Thanos' butt and then re-enlarges, and Thanos goes, "Ooh!" and explodes.
Lisa,
I've been to the spoiler sites. I've read all about it. That's how the movie ends.
Yes, that's exactly
the movie ends with Ant-Man
flying
up Thanos' butt. This is a high-class podcast. Flying up Thanos' butt. I'll say it a third time. Flying up Thanos' butt and exploding.
All of our sponsors regret everything.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
They were gone for 2019, huh?
Yeah. So, you know what movie I have actually seen a lot of this year, believe it or not?
Mm-hmm.
Thor Ragnarok. You want to know why?
Because our daughter loves it.
Our daughter loves it. And I've now seen it 5 times.
Okay.
Because she adores it.
Can I share some other movies that I've seen?
Yes, you may.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the room while you watch most of these movies, so technically I've probably seen some of them too.
You've been on a plane where I watched one of these movies. I saw Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yeah.
On a plane.
Uh-huh.
Where, oddly enough, they edited out the bad language, even though the only person listening to the bad language was me, the person who made a conscious decision to watch this movie that might have bad language in it.
Uh-huh.
Anyhow, it's good. It's good. I'd like to see it again, the unexpurgated version, because apparently it ends with quite Richard E. Grant saying quite a salty thing that is meant affectionately.
Uh-huh.
And Melissa McCarthy says, "Hey, you too." And mm-hmm. it's a very tender moment.
Yeah.
And on this edit, it's Richard E. Grant's voice drops out entirely.
Uh-huh.
And then she goes, "Hey, you too." And then you're all, "What has happened?"
Oh, same flight. I saw Bohemian Rhapsody while you're seeing that.
Yeah.
Which is, again, probably not a film you want to see edited on an airplane.
Mm-mm.
The version that I saw left me
So you saw the Russian version then?
I don't even know what I saw. Yeah. Yes, Freddie Mercury just feels very warmly towards all of humanity.
Yeah, Freddie Mercury likes a lot of people.
So my mom, who is retired now, goes to the movies every Tuesday because Tuesday is the cheapy cinema day where you can go for $6. My mom goes all the time. And she went to see Bohemian Rhapsody back when it was in theaters, like a human, like she was like a human being. Mm-hmm. And she comes back and I'm like, so, and bear in mind, my mother stopped listening to popular music once John Denver dropped off the top 40. Like that was it. That was the end of pop culture.
I was afraid you were going to say once John Denver dropped out of the sky. Oh, I was going to go, wow, that's a harsh reaction, but we all deal with tragedy in our own way.
No, my mom's heyday was the folk.
Okay.
The folk music. And so, like, once acid rock hit in the 70s, that was the end of it for her.
Yeah, sure.
So, if she knew who Queen was, it was because she caught a Coffee Generation commercial. So I'm like, oh. And I'm curious to see how my mother is going to handle Freddie Mercury. Like, I've seen documentaries about him. I've read books. And, you know, the man did not lead a quiet life.
No.
And I'm also, how was it? My mom's like, well, he had a lot of love to give.
Oh, God, put that on the poster.
But like,
put that on the DVD cover.
But
he had a lot of love to give.
But like,
Raves and a retiree from Alameda, California.
But like, the thing is in the movie, he doesn't have any love. He just has like warm handshakes for people.
Yeah, well, only on the plane.
Yeah. Rami Malek's performance, from what I could understand, was great.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the movie read as though it was edited by a man who had timers running for Brian May and Roger Taylor and the other dude I'm forgetting in Queen.
Deacon.
Thank you. Brian Deacon?
John Deacon.
John Deacon. Okay. I don't care. And was making sure that all of them got like equal minutes in the film. But what I found weird, and maybe this is something that happens when you can remember the original event, is the Live Aid sequence is beautifully filmed. And again, Rami Malek does a great job. But like, when you get a chance, go on YouTube and watch the original Freddie Mercury performance, because that's electric.
Also, and I haven't seen the movie, don't they have a scene where like they're all, oh, this Live Aid's a dud?
Yes, they did. Until Freddie Mercury.
The phones aren't ringing,
until
people.
Until Freddie Mercury and his light-washed Levi's prance across the stage, and then all of a sudden everyone is compelled to save the kids in Africa.
we're not moving any paper here.
Yeah, no, so. it's ridiculous. Because I was like, oh, now they've noticed Live Aid. It's so dumb. Mm-hmm. It's dumb and it's false. And I feel sorry for the teachers of the year 2040 who are going to be grading term papers on the life of Freddie Mercury going, that didn't actually happen.
Yeah. as opposed to all of us who wrote our Freddie Mercury term papers in 1986 and got all the facts correct.
Well, we were there. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyhow, Can You Ever Forgive Me? Two great performances by Melissa McCarthy and uh-huh. Richard E. Grant. I'd recommend it. Another movie I recommend, an older movie,
mm-hmm.
not as good, but enjoyable to me, is The Mask of Demetrius, which is this late 1940s picture with Peter Lorre and Sidney mm-hmm. Greenstreet. Anytime those two get together, it is fun.
I saw that with you, yes. I kept popping in and out of it.
Yeah, basically, Peter Lorre is a crime writer.
Yeah.
He's in Turkey, and the police chief, there was this guy named and tells a story about a criminal, and mm-hmm. and it really gets the hooks into Peter Lorre, and he begins to investigate, and thus begins a multi-European globe-trotting tour.
Oh, wow.
Tour, yeah. Where each one brings him closer to Demetrius and all the crazy uh-huh. criminal things Demetrius did, and Sidney Greenstreet is there too as who has a vested interest in finding Demetrius, and it's a very fun picture.
Yeah.
Also, since it was made long ago, it zips along, and even if you don't like it, it's really only maybe 90 minutes of your life.
Again, to get back to Baby Driver,
mm-hmm.
which I want to point out, a lot of good performances.
Yep.
Beautifully shot. Love the music. You and I were, 2 hours into it? We were like, oh my God.
We weren't even 2 hours into it.
We were 90 minutes into it.
Because the movie is about 2 hours long.
Yeah, and 90 minutes into it.
Which these days is a compact movie.
And 90 minutes in, we were both like, oh my God, there's still half an hour to go. Because it had run out of story by that point.
Yeah, there's not a lot of story in Baby Driver for all its other charms.
Yeah.
And you're all, how are you going to fill the rest of this 30 minutes? And the answer is a lot of the same mm-hmm. stuff over and over again. And it begins to lose its charm, I would argue, in the third act.
Well, because the third act goes on for forever.
Yeah.
And also, the person who ends up being the main antagonist at some point flips from being human to basically being the Mike Myers, Freddy Krueger, super-powered vengeance machine guy. And by that point, I was like, no. Like, no. Just learn to let people die on a schedule.
Yeah.
So, let them die on a schedule. But yeah, it's been interesting. I think I've also been watching a lot of documentaries lately.
And, any good ones?
Well, that's a good question, because there are documentaries I enjoy, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're good.
Mm.
For example, I greatly enjoy the documentary called The First Monday in May. It's about putting on the 2014 Met Gala, which was a fantastical exhibition of fashion that was interpreted by Westerners who were inspired by China. So, oh God. Well, like...
That sounds career-ending for some people.
Well, it was... I think what was fascinating about it was how out of date it seems now, simply because to be able to go to China and say to Chinese people with a straight face, well, this is about Westerners' interpretation of your country, is kind of a mind blower. Like, just imagine having the stones to do that.
Right.
Especially since China has, like, great whoopsie loads of money right now, and they're actually filled with couture customers who are have very different ideas about Chinese. But the reason I enjoy it as a film is it, first of all, everything's still very pretty. It shows people's fanatical devotion to things that ostensibly don't matter in the grand scheme, but matter in terms of the human spirit. It shows people who are not afraid to be fanatically detail-oriented and extremely precise about what they want and indefatigable in getting it. I always enjoy watching people who are really in their professional prime and their flow doing what they excel at. So those are the kind of documentaries I really like. So I watched that. There's a Wendy Whalen documentary. She was a ballet. She's now a co-director at the New York City Ballet following their terrible harassment scandals. But she was a dancer there for 23, 24 years. And it basically follows to the end of her career as a principal dancer with the ballet. And it really gives you an appreciation for the athleticism of the job and what it takes to get and stay where she is. Like the wide and varied skill set that they have. And I enjoyed that one too.
Okay.
And the other problem is, Phil, we canceled our cable.
Yes, we did.
But now we have access to like all these streaming services because we have Netflix, we have Hulu, we have Amazon Prime. And what I've found is that because we have all these streaming services, I can dip in and out of things much faster. And so the experience of sitting and immersing myself in a movie, like I'm sure I've had them. I'm just not remembering them. I'm kind of more vividly remembering scrolling through going, nap, 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 you know?
Yes.
It's a little disquieting that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll start taking better notes for you all, dear listeners, because Philip and I have made a promise to ourselves to not make this an annual podcast.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, speaking of that, we
see you all in 2020.
Oh, God. I just made the promise. But you know what? We have taken up enough of your time with 15 minutes. I do pop into the member Slack from time to time. So drop suggestions for movies to watch or movies you'd like to hear our feedback on if we have watched them. And we'll certainly be in to chat with you. Or you can hit me up on Twitter at LSCHMEISER. And I'll be there too to read, respond, react. Thank you so much for hanging in there with us and being so patient with us. I really appreciate it.
And as for me, do not make contact with me. Do not look me in the eye. If you see me on the street, look away.
Baby, look away.
I'll accept a respectful nod and maybe I'll return it.
You have to look at him through an eclipse viewer is what you say.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. But I'm too bright. I'll stun your retinas.
Anyway, I want to thank you all for your time.
Yes, absolutely.
And your patronage. We appreciate you all very much.
Thank you.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.